Welcome to Gudarius Live for a Wagon Wheel podcast today. Best way, this is the podcast that of course answers your questions on cricket. The best way to get those questions is if you're in the YouTube, you can go and give us a super chat. And if not, you can go to our Patreon, Gudarius Podcast, find us over there. And you can send them in beforehand, like MF Jim has, who says, was Connolly an Evan Gilbert selection? Also, can I now claim to be a talent scout for calling his selection a mile out? Yeah, I remember, MF, you doing that on like one of our lives, and I was like, they're not going to take Connolly. Or certainly I thought if he went, he would go more as a, you know, player to get experience. Not that he was going to play, but well done there. One of the more interesting debuts of all time, or the least interesting debuts of all time. No, I don't think it was a Gilbert selection. I just thought they probably thought they could get, what, 10 to 15 overs out of him in innings. They already 1-0 up in the series. Probably, you know, some of those wickets now, I think what you're seeing a lot more is teams are pretty comfortable of having just two spinners do, you know, the bulk of the work, or three spinners doing the bulk of the work. But yeah, no, I think it was more about getting experience. I don't think it was any sort of Gilbert-like action. Mob King says, why don't runouts count towards the bowler's wicket tally? Not always, but quite often a runout can be earned by a batter being terrified of facing the bowler. I mean, they haven't earned the wicket, have they? If you go through it, there's quite a few things in cricket that it's kind of interesting that why doesn't, I think there's a few others. Do you get handled the ball in the old days? You might have got handled the ball. There's a couple that you get and there's a couple that you don't get. And I always found it weird how we, like, how we differentiate between those anyway. And the fact that someone decided that a runout doesn't go to the bowler is quite interesting early on, because could we not have also done the same thing with overthrows and misfields? Right? Even, you know, and then no balls didn't go to the bowler, and then eventually they did. Like, there's a few different things, I think, when you go through them where there isn't, like, a strong current. I don't think bowlers should get runouts as well. In their bowling tally, but also I don't really understand why a misfield, although there was a hilarious misfield the other day that would have gone to the bowler, which was, oh my God, was it Hashirana? He was about to bowl a maiden and the ball was blocked back to him and he just threw it for four overthrows. Absolute genius level cricket. Loved it. Ian says, if you were the agent of a talented young player whose skills seemed best suited to the red ball game, but they were Dutch, or given the state of the FDB, Irish or Zimbabwean, what advice would you give them on how to pursue their career? No, I think if there's a chance of them moving to white ball cricket and them still being like their skill, let's say their skills are more suited to red ball cricket, but they're still a very good white ball cricketer, then I wouldn't have any issue with them still playing white ball cricket. If it's a case of where they're only ever going to be a red ball cricketer and it's going to be very hard, almost impossible for them to ever play white ball cricket, probably what I would do at that point would be have a conversation with them to see if you could set them up as a, let's say, a Dutch, Irish or Zimbabwean player who also plays county cricket, because there's still quite a bit of money in county cricket. But they have to be aware that that is where they're going at that stage. I think most players will just try and get better at white ball cricket. I mean, if Dom Sibley can play white ball cricket, if Keaton Jennings can play white ball cricket, I think it does tell you that everyone has that ability. Like Chris Rogers probably could have worked it out in a different generation. Maybe not Craig Brathwaite. Ali says, it seems like in terms of skills that ODIs are closer to tests than T20s. Would it make more sense to have separate squad along those lines rather than white ball, red ball squads? I don't know if I agree with you on that. I think it's a very interesting point. But yeah, Ali, I'm not sure 100% agree with you there. It is the in the middle format, right? And I suppose it depends on how you play. Like, they're really three different formats and they're not really treated that way at the moment. I suppose that's probably the more important way of doing it in the future. Ben says, do you think Steve Smith is somewhere back to his best, or that recent team conditions haven't bowled enough balls, 5-6 stump line, back of a good leg? No, I think he's worked some of that out, Ben. I mean, he's had a couple of years of struggling against the same thing, and he's a very smart player. Like, over a period of time, he's going to work it out, right? He's going to work out how to do that. So, subcontinental conditions are a little bit different when you look at what's going on in Sri Lanka. I thought India was still bowling the right line of lengths to him. I thought he was, I don't know if lucky is the right way, but scratchy in that first 100 against India. And then looked like he'd worked through some things. And that's kind of how he plays, right? He, you know, and when he comes out the other side, I wouldn't say he's back to his best, because his best is, you know, about as great as we've ever had. But I think he's back to being, you know, he's back to a form that could carry him for the next 4 or 5 years, as long as other parts of his game don't crumble behind it. Cab says, why does it feel like most mainstream broadcasters, mostly ex-players from Big Three Nations, have awful takes or just factually incorrect details about the proposed two-tier World Test Championship? Genuine quote from the recent Sri Lanka Australian series on the radio. Zimbabwe are currently playing Ireland and no one cares. Well, I mean, that is true, isn't it? As in, no one cares from a World Test Championship perspective. That particular Ireland-Zimbabwe test, like the Zimbabwe-Afghanistan test did quite well, I think, from what I was told. Like, people did watch them. Zimbabwe seemed to make this one almost impossible to find. Shout out to Dermot in our Discord chat, who gave me a link to it so I could actually find a way to watch it play. I think Big Three people quite often talk down about other cricket. I think you have to ignore that. I don't think that many people actually know that much about World Test Championship and two tiers. I don't think the vast majority of comments in cricket that are made publicly are made by people who've actually done the work. You know, I spent a lot of time following American sports, and you come back to cricket and you just realize how often someone will say something and they won't know anything about it. MF Jim says, has Bazball just played Rohit into form? No, they didn't go that short in that last innings, did they? I actually thought it was quite weird. You know, commentating on it, I was like, where are the bounces, guys? What's happening here? I think that some of the bounce had gone out of that wicket, so when they did try it, it didn't quite work. But yeah, he played the same shots on what was probably a better batting wicket. Maybe they, instead of, like, he played the shot across the line that he's been hitting straight up in the air for months, right? He plays that shot and he smacks it for six. Maybe the wicket came on a little bit better, or he was seeing the ball a little bit better. But these things happen. It sometimes it doesn't take much to click back into form. Nicholas, oh my God, Nicholas. This is the world's longest ever chat. Okay. The late 90s, early 2000s Zimbabwe team has to be overrated, right? People still talk about the quality of that team, and they were great relative to other Zimbabwe teams. However, they only had one truly great player, one very good player, and then they had a bunch of other bits and pieces players, probably. I don't really understand what you're saying, Nicholas. No one has ever said that this was like a top four team in the world. We are saying that that was a team that was very hard to beat. They were a very defensive team, so they weren't easy to blow through. They had a lot of good professional role-playing type players. People like Campbell and Grant Flower, or is like, you know, you had to get through them. They didn't have the most talented bowling attack, but they kind of had bowlers. Like, there was a lineup there that they could assemble. They were still like the second lowest ranked side. I think the only side who was ranked below them was England very briefly, and then obviously Bangladesh later on. So I think in your head, when you hear people say that they had a good side at that stage, you're the one who's overblowing it, right? Like, I think you're thinking of it in the wrong way. The current Zimbabwe side is a very good side, but there's a lot of holes within the current side. Like, I don't know if you could get past Ngarava and Blessing with a new ball. Like, if you were to play the current Zimbabwe side versus that one from the late 90s, I just wonder how they would get through, you know, that stronger middle order. Unless Blessing or Ngarava went on a run. And that's the one big strength that the current team has. But yeah, no one was, and their main success was probably 99 World Cup. Again, that was Neil Johnson, who only played with them for a little while. But they had Flower and Goodwin, who were both world-class batters. They had a bunch of batters who were, like, above West Indian level, right? They had Heath Streak, who gave them versatility. They did have a lot of bowlers who could come and go and were okay. But no one, I think yeah, I think this is one of those things where you've kind of got it in your head a little bit that everyone thought they were better. What we thought is that they had built a cricket side that you had to go through. Like, they were not a collapsible cricket side, which is pretty much between then and now what they have been. Panda Cyborg says, Sam Curran is a player I've had a minor obsession with. Awesome. He doesn't appear to be in England's current plans at any format, which has only heightened my interest. He seems to have a lot of skills in various aspects of the game, including captaincy, but nothing that makes him elite at any of those aspects. If you could control him like a video game character, how would you develop him from here on in? Look, I think a couple of things happened with Sam Curran. He tried to get the wobble ball going and it ruined his swing. And so that took away a big part of his effectiveness. But there really isn't a part of his game that I think is world-class. So I suppose if you're working with him, that's the only thing you can do. Now, he's not ever going to be quicker. So perhaps going back to swinging it again and getting rid of the wobble ball. I just don't think he's ever going to be a good enough batter to be world-class in any of those positions either. I think you have to understand what Sam Curran is. I think he could still fit in well to certain teams. And I think if you put Sam Curran in the team of 5 or 6 years ago, he probably fits quite well. But I think that Sam Curran is a player who needs to be in the ideal environment where you don't need him to bowl his full allocation and you don't need him to bat in the top six. Then I think you have a really interesting player. If you need either of those two things, I just don't think his skills are high enough to do that. So you need an environment like Chennai had and like England used to have around him that allows you to use him at his best. I don't think there's anything you can. He's tried to become a specialist batter, moved up the order at Surrey. As far as I've heard, I don't know Sam, you know, other than meeting him very briefly. As far as I've heard, he has spent a lot of time trying to get better at batting, and he's still roughly at the same level. He might still develop though. All rounders sometimes do that later on. MF Jim says, could we see Australia play a warm-up game against Ireland for the World Test Championship final? I would have thought they would have already announced it if that was the case. So I don't think that's coming. I don't think it would happen in Ireland because Ireland would have to build Malahide up, right? So didn't Ireland cancel some games for a similar reason and they played them in England? So if it's going to happen, it would have to be outside of Ireland. And I would have assumed it would have already been announced, but maybe not. The Tooth says, how much did the absence of Jeff Jonathan affect Australia's recent World Cup and their death bowling in general? Look, I haven't looked at her death bowling figures over the last couple of years. I got the feeling from the outside that they were thinking that they could replace Jeff Jonathan with other players who were maybe more slightly, had a higher upside in other parts of the game, you know, batting and fielding and things like that. You know, for a long time, she was the dominant sort of death bowler in the world. Eccleston might have slightly gone past her of recent times, but I think for a long time, she was dominant. I think that played a part, but realistically, I think they still should have made the final and probably should have won it even without her. But yeah, I don't think this is like Glenn McGrath rolling his ankle on a cricket ball. Turf. Person says, you mentioned a couple of times that England were pretty bad at tests in the 80s. And if you promoted relegated existed, they might have been relegated. After Nicholas's question, Zimbabwe were, I think, briefly ranked ahead of them. I don't, you know, the ICC rankings are not really my cup of tea, but and I don't even drink tea. That's how much they're not my cup of tea. But there was no doubt that they really struggled over a prolonged period of time. Was a very shambolic situation. I think what happened is they had been carried for a long period of time by the fact that they produced better cricketers than everyone else. So everyone else, except for brief periods where Australia dominated, England still had the best cricketers. Like if you go through, even a lot of their best players don't even play that regularly, right? And they were still a pretty dominant side all the way through. You know, they got Bradmond, and obviously, you know, there were some other times when Australia was at their level or above them, like early 1920s and things like that. But realistically, I still think for overall talent, I think England was probably better. But county cricket was the most important thing, and cricket was run for county cricket, whereas Shield cricket was run for the Australian team. And other countries sort of did a similar thing because they're trying to build their nations. That's not what was happening in England, right? It's a very different situation. And then once you get to the 70s and 80s, you get the professionalism starts to come in through England, right? And a little bit of Kerry Packer, right? A little bit of rebel leagues as well, but a little bit of Kerry Packer and a little bit of county cricket and league cricket, right? And so you get two teams that really benefit from that, West Indies and Pakistan. New Zealand put together a really good team on the back of having Richard Hadlee and Martin Crowe, right? So very, you know, almost like an exaggerated version of what we were talking about with Zimbabwe before, right? Some really good players, but essentially they had two fantastic players and they built a whole team around them. So you now have three teams that had never really been at the top level before. West Indies had flirted with it, but not quite got there consistently. All at that level. Two of them have got professional. The other one, hilariously amateur. Then you have Australia come through, and Australia brings through with it the sort of professionalism, the start of sort of from Packer that comes through, and cricket is played as a job for the first time in Australia. You know, shield cricketers get more money. There are there's a union. So Australia has a huge surge through their professionalism. And then you get India and Sri Lanka with their passion, really, as much as anything, and the talent of cricketers that they both have come through. So England is kind of kept in the same system that they've always been in. And it wasn't run to make the English cricket team the best it should be. So, you know, you have five captains in one summer and all these sorts of things, and the selections don't really make sense. And you've got to go back. If you go back, there wasn't really ever a strong English cricket board. There was the MCC when they toured, and then at home they had the TCCB, which was kind of a small authority. The ECB's only just started to get formed around that period. And so there isn't really a strong idea of what an English cricket team should be. Whereas in Sri Lanka, it's like, where, you know, it's such an important thing playing for Sri Lanka. And what the English players were saying in the 90s, when they were starting to get good, they were saying things like, well, we want to go on, you know, A tours together, and we want to prepare and do all this sort of stuff that was already happening in Australia. Right. And then, that's when the sort of professional boom comes through. And from the time that the ECB starts running the England team as if it's the most important team, you do start to see them rise. Even it's not overnight. It takes about a decade, which it did with Australia. Australia's professionalism boom took about a decade and a half, really. Josh says, hypothetical bowler, economy. Hey. Eric Economy is an upcoming test bowler. He's accurate spinner who can bowl all day if you need him to. He bowls such a tight line that he always goes for exactly one run and over. Unfortunately, he's never taken a wicket in his life. And he bats as well as Chris Martin. And he has an unfortunate allergy to white cricket balls, so he can only play in the longer formats. Eric is going to be one of the all-time great test bowlers, or is he not good enough to play a test? So this depends on what you have at the other end. You could get away, Josh, with a bowler like this. So let's say because one run and over is so low. That means that every day you're going for 45 runs from one end. Well, it's modern test cricket. You're going for about 38 runs from one end. It means that players at the other end are going to have to take extraordinary risks to score at a decent rate. So from the other 40 or so overs, even if you scored at 5 runs and over, you're still only scoring 250 runs a day. The way that modern cricket is played, I could see how that works. But you also need strike bowlers. So you would need three significant strike bowlers to be able to supplement a bowler like Economy, I would think. Otherwise, you're just going to draw a lot of games, aren't you? MF Jim says, Joel Wilson has had 35% of his decisions overturned in 2024. How is he still getting a job? The average overturn rate is 22.4%. I don't know any of those numbers. That's fantastic. Yeah, I think the biggest issue for me has always been promotion and relegation of umpires. There are some umpires who, like, if you, there was that period where, oh my God, Alim Dar went through a huge form dip. And like, if you talk to people in Australia, like, Alim Dar is a terrible umpire. Like, Alim Dar was a great umpire for a long time, but he did go through a form dip. I think if it's someone like Alim Dar, who's been like umpire of the year 3 or 4 times in a row, or has great numbers overall, like if, you know, I've now forgotten all the umpires' name, but the good English umpire and the good Indian umpire I'm thinking of, I think you would give them some leeway. You wouldn't drop them after one bad year. But there are other umpires like Joel Wilson who I think consistently would be in the lower end, right? they deserve to go down. And I think that there is a big issue with that system, that essentially what happens is once you get on the gravy train, it's very hard to get off it. And so we end up with umpires who make a lot of mistakes consistently, I would say. All right, let's have a quick break here. And when we come back, more of the Wagon Wheel. A few years ago, I realized that trying to find the best stories in cricket was impossible for any fan. I even tried to get funding to make my own cricket Huffington Post. It never quite worked. But luckily, we finally have someone filling this massive void in our game, Best of Cricket. They scour the publications everywhere to find, quite simply, all the best news and the greatest stories on our sport. Then they make it just as easy. They either email it or WhatsApp it direct to you. Cricket's greatest tales delivered to your device. This is truly the best of cricket. Jane says, might be too basic a question. There's no such thing. But what on earth happened in the Sri Lanka-Australia series? Sri Lanka have some decent spinners. Australia really only have Lyon. And a 2-0 whitewash doesn't make a lot of sense to me, especially given that Sri Lanka had pretty decent 2024. I think Sri Lanka is a good team and they're assembling a decent side. But I think their record has flattered them for a little while. And I don't think they have a great spinning bowling attack. I actually think I like their seamers more, if we're being honest. I like their limited overs attack. I think in Test cricket, Jayasurya is such a sort of one and done guy at times. But yeah, I think if I was considering how they played against New Zealand, I would be pretty disappointed if I was Sri Lanka at the moment. But I do think that they had overperformed at times, and there's always going to be a little bit of a comeback. I thought from a long period of time that there was a big chance of 1-1 in that series. It never even felt like it could be 1-1, right? There was one period, was it in the second test, where Australia was even money and Sri Lanka was even money. I think they were 3 down for about 100. And I was like, that's a good bet. That's a good bet on Australia at the moment. And that was about the only time. The rest of the time, it just looked like Sri Lanka weren't even in those games. MF Jim says, how would you handle a player like Marnus in his form slump? His personality mixed with the fact he's doing just enough to hang in with a solid start every few games. I thought he needed a break. I think players like him need to understand that there is a world outside of making runs. And it's really hard for a player like him to understand that. And I think he just needed a break from the game and he needed to, just have a pause and then come back to it later. You don't have to play cricket the whole time. If you're not doing it well, sometimes that's what you need to do. So that's what I think I said that during that series, ended up making runs. Everything else, I'm not too worried about him. I think people think that there's an issue with someone just doing enough to hang in with a solid start of review games is an issue. That shows that there's still something there to work with. We don't think about it that way in cricket because we're like, oh, this guy's got to get dropped. Oh, he can't get dropped now because he's made a 60 or whatever. That's the wrong way to look at it. The right way to look at it is if he's getting to 40 and he's getting to 60, then there is actually something there that is still working. So I'm not too worried about that. But I think when he really was struggling, just these sort of, let's call them obsessive batting people, like, you know, Jonathan Trott and Marnus Labuschagne and, you know, whoever else you want to put in that. I just think sometimes when that is all that is in their mind, I can't see how that's a good thing when you're going through a slump. I think when you're going through a slump, that's when you need to be like, okay, take a break and I'll come back to it later. Rudra says, one of the first cricket matches I ever saw was India versus Australia, the 2006 Champions Trophy. Australia's bowling attack was McGrath, Lee, Bracken, Johnson, Watson, and Simons. So no special spinner for a match in India. That Brad Hogg and Dan Cullen and squad. So it's not like no spinner was available. India played Harbhajan, Sehwag, and Dinesh Munjal combined for 1 for 49 from the 12 overs. So there was definitely some use for spinners. Was being pace heavy a typical ODI approach in India at the time? I feel like now I couldn't imagine Australia leaving out Zampa for any limited overs game. My guess is that Hogg was injured or Hogg wasn't bowling particularly well against India at that time. That would be the two obvious things for me, Rudra, from that. Hogg played a lot of cricket. I don't think Hogg's record in ODI cricket, when you look at the advanced stats, is that much different than Shane Warne's. I know there was a feeling in Australia that the one team he struggled against was India. I haven't looked at his record, but I remember that being an issue. So it could have been something as simple as that. Cullen probably just wasn't seen up to it. So they went with Simons, maybe bowling a little bit of part-time spin. Thatchbo says, how many test all-rounders have you watched who were genuine test class in both disciplines? None. There's been none in modern cricket. I suppose Botham being the last one. I thought Callis was a really good bowler. I'm not sure. I think Callis is the one that if he wanted to just be a specialist bowler, I could see that. I think I could see Stokes being a specialist bowler. I don't think I could see him being a specialist batter. Like, I just, he doesn't average over 40. I don't see it. And I don't think his bowling load has had a problem. Cronier averaged 11 with the ball versus Sachin and 50 versus McGrath with the bat. Yeah, it wasn't Cronier. I mean, he was dog shit. His bowling was dog shit. He certainly wasn't playing a test match. Yeah, Callis and Stokes are interesting. Flintoff is interesting, right? The problem is that all-rounders don't develop in the same way. So it's actually very unlikely that someone is going to be a test-class batter and a test-class bowler because it takes so much for anyone to become a test-class batter or a test-class bowler, and they have half the amount of time that everyone else has. So it's really unlikely. So Keith Miller or Ben Stokes, maybe if they were spending all their time batting, bat well enough to play as specialist batters. And if Callis spent all of his time bowling, he probably played well enough to play as a specialist bowler. But it's really rare. Like, if we're being honest, even Imran in the 90s, I suppose you might pick his batting. I just don't think Imran in the 90s or Jadeja of, you know, recent form Jadeja, you're picking as a specialist batter. You're picking them because they can do the other skill and they give you a decent option, and sometimes they're going to outscore other batters in their side, but I don't know if you would pick them as a specialist batter. Aubrey Faulkner is maybe the most interesting one, right? Because he averages over 40 with the bat. He was definitely going to get picked with the bat, and he was also in their best two or three bowlers. But his career is weird because he's not like a consistent all-rounder. He's kind of like a batter at some stages and a bowler at other stages. Who else am I missing there? Yeah, so both of them in Flintoff. I wonder if they developed differently, if they weren't, especially with their batting. So they both could have played as frontline bowlers. I think that's probably fair to say. But could they have played as frontline batters if they were batting more sensibly at times? Like, they both had a license because they were all-rounders. And so it does take some off your overall average. You know, I think Kapil Dev would have averaged higher, right? Like, Hadley, I think, is lucky to be in the all-rounder category because there happen to be three other guys. But all three of the other guys, I think, like, I could have. But yeah, it's just not something you see very often. But the other side of that is, we've seen in first-class cricket, lots of players switch, right? So Bob Knocker-White plays Middlesex and averages, I don't know, mid-30s as a batter and then goes up to Nottingham and becomes a frontline off-spinner. So in first-class cricket, I think that shows you that there are players who Knocker could obviously bowl. He didn't learn to bowl at 28, but he probably didn't get the opportunity in Middlesex. I probably had other spinners. I'd have to go back and have a look who was around. And so in first-class cricket, you see that sort of stuff a lot. You know, you see players like Moeen Ali, who's not an all-rounder, and then late career becomes an all-rounder, and he was good enough to make it to test level. I think you do see that quite a bit in first-class cricket. And I think what that shows you is that he was probably specialising so much as a batter when he was younger and didn't get the opportunity as a bowler, but had that talent. And there's lots of first-class players like that. That it's a very hard thing to say. It's a very hard thing for you to come through at 23, 24 as that level of player, right? So if you are Vittori or Jadeja or Imran Khan, and over the full amount of your career you can develop, right, then you probably become at certain times a genuine player who can play both roles and maybe could be picked for both roles. But for the vast majority of your career, you probably can't. Varun has said a batting average of 42 is equal to a bowling average of 27. So a pure all-rounder probably at least does both. And the only person I know of in the history of the game who has those numbers is Aubrey Faulkner. He didn't play a lot of cricket either. So no one has done that before. But people have done it over periods of time. So I think it's more just about the development. So Garfield Sobers, again, is another player who comes in as a left-arm finger spinner. His batting then develops quicker. His bowling isn't used all that much in the first half of his career. And then in the second half of his career, he is playing as a frontline bowler and a frontline batter, right? Like, it's remarkable what happens in the second half of his career. But that took him a generation of not being able to do that, right? Like, almost a decade, I think. I could be wrong. Maybe it was 7 or 8 years, where he wasn't a frontline bowler or even anything close to a frontline bowler. So, and he's the most all-round player we've ever had. So the answer is that that I don't think there has really been, unless you say Aubrey Faulkner, Garfield Sobers, and Tony Gregg are three very interesting ones on this. But like, going back and watching Tony Gregg bowl, would Tony Gregg, I don't think Tony Gregg, well, I'm just having a look at his bowling average now. He averaged 32. So I think Tony Gregg's more like that callous kind of guy that if Tony Gregg wasn't a professional batter, he probably would have worked on his bowling well enough to be a frontline bowler. But he didn't have to. And he didn't have time to, especially with Tony Gregg. He had a lot of insurance ads to make. So I think we have had players with the talent to be able to do both. Keith Miller certainly won. Garfield Sobers, callous. I think Ben Stokes is someone, you look at both his batting and his bowling, and I'd be fascinated. I think he was more easily talented enough if he just spent all of his time batting or just spent all of his time bowling to be a specialist, but he's kind of just below both, right? Like, you look at him sometimes and his line of length is all over the place. He can't control the new white ball. You know, just the micro skills of a specialist bowler he doesn't have, right? But again, I think he was more talented enough. I think both of them was talented enough. I think Kapil Dev was probably a step down from that. Shakib Al Hasan is another fascinating one. Shakib Al Hasan might also be, he might be up there with that Tony Gregg where you're just like, probably, but would Shakib Al Hasan have been able to do that for a better team? That's always been the question I've had is, you know, when you play for a lower level team, but let me just look at his record overall. So a test, he averages 37. So for a really good side, you probably don't want your specialist batter to have a 37, and he averages 31 with the ball. He's another Tony Gregg one for me. I think, again, he probably is just, he's really, really close, but doesn't quite get there. It's a fascinating question. I suppose, Sachmo, if the question is, do people have the talent to do both? I would say yes. If the question is, do people have the time and ability to hone their skills the way they should have? Outside of Aubrey Faulkner, I don't think we've ever seen it. And remember, Aubrey Faulkner is a fluke, right? Because he was a professional batter all of his life, and then he was taught this magical skill of a wrong-un, and without that, he's probably more of a part-time bowler. Let's have another break, and then after the break, more of this kind of thing being the wagon wheel. And that is why Australia decided to drop Shane Keith Warne. Cricket is a game of strategy, of picking the right players for the right moment, or playing the right shots at the right ball. And Hit Wicket captures that perfectly. In Hit Wicket, you're not just picking a team, you're collecting cricket legends, expanding your squad with each new addition. The more players you have, the more options you have to dominate in any situation. And then comes the real challenge, picking your playing 11. Who are your opener, run machine, and Mr. 360? Do you stack your top order with aggressive batters, or do you build a solid foundation? And what about your bowling attack? Do you go with pace, spin, a mixture of both? We've got the Tasmanian Devil, Jimmy, and Boom. The possibility are endless. The beauty of Hit Wicket is that you need to adapt your lineup to your opponent. They can be powerful, balanced, and technical. Each class has an edge over another. It's a tactical dance where you need to anticipate your opponent's moves and exploit their weaknesses. So if you think you've got the strategic mind to build a championship team, download Hit Wicket and prove it. All right, Bloody Bugger says, how much scouting happens at Tier 2 T20 leagues in India? Tamil Nadu, Premier League, and those sorts of things. Yeah, I think a lot of that. I think most scouting now is people just watching, you know, the Tamil Nadu League, the Karnataka League, and I'm missing another one, aren't I? There's a third one that they like looking at as well, which is really good. I think that's what cricket should be doing, of course. But I think I would be casting a wider net than that. And we've seen some players with fantastic numbers in that that don't translate. So I think the other thing you need to work out is what numbers from those leagues do translate and what numbers don't. Richard says, for all the bowlers who bowled more than 1,000 balls during Richard Hadlee's career, only Joel Garner, Max Walker, Mike Kendrick, and Bob Willis had better economy rates. But that brings up the question, who is Maxwell Walker? Cricket First says he was Australia's third seamer behind Lilly and Thompson. How did he not play more than 34 tests and 17 ODIs with numbers like he had? Or was it just Packer? Yeah, he was a Packer player. Max Walker is, I don't want to say the first big cricketer because Jack Blackham is from Tasmania. But Max Walker is a remarkable figure. In Australia, he is much more famous now for not being a cricketer than being a cricketer. I'm trying to think of a version of Max Walker for other countries to even understand. I suppose there's maybe a small percent. No, because everyone who knows Freddie Flintoff as a celebrity still knows he played cricket. There must be other versions. It's a bit like when Mark Nicholas was doing what Britain's Best Dish, and I don't think people knew he was a cricketer. Australia's had a couple of them. Max Walker and Mike Whitney, who are really famous in Australia, and I don't think the average person who would have known their name would have known that they played cricket. Max Walker was just a fantastic athlete. So he played Aussie rules football professionally. He played cricket professionally. But the reason he didn't play more is, to go back to what I was saying before, he was born in Tasmania, and in Tasmania, they didn't have a first-class team. Well, they didn't have a Shield team at that stage. And so I don't know when he comes over to Victoria. Let me see. Where's his debut first class game? Yeah, so he starts playing in 68 and he was born in 48. I wonder when he starts playing consistently. So I wonder if there was an element of that that held him back a little bit. He was an all-rounder. He had this incredible action, kind of like Mike Proctor. His nickname was Tangles because of his bowling action. And if you go back and you have a look, it's a fascinating one. He sort of almost knocked himself out as he came in. It's a really good action to have, not to copy, but to Google. His batting, he was always talked about as an all-rounder. It never really came through. So he was a specialist bowler. He wasn't particularly fast, but very economical, on a spot, very clever kind of cricketer. And then he plays for Packer. So yeah, he probably misses, when's his last first class game? 81. So I reckon he probably had a few good years left, but he was so popular as a personality that he goes off into the media. Now, I'm going to have to read these out, but this is, if you guys haven't heard this is, you have no idea. My wife, we went into an antique store in Country Victoria, and my wife called me over to show me the cricket books. And I was like, you don't want to look at the cricket books. You want to look at Max Walker's books, because he was a cricketer and this is what he wrote. Now, see if I can find them here. I don't even think all of them are online, by the way. All right. So you've got How to Hypnotize Chooks, How to Kiss a Crocodile, How to Puzzle a Python. I reckon there's a couple more as well. He's got The Best of Mr. Walker, How to Tame Lions. What was the other one he had? The Wit and Witticisms of Max Walker. I can't even find that one, but I reckon I've got that one. He's got like 18 books, and they're not really about cricket, and some of them have great cricket stories in them, but they're just bizarre, and he becomes famous for this. He then becomes famous again as like a sports host outside of cricket. So he loses the Channel 9 job. That ends up being a huge part of the his late legacy, because it becomes part of the 12th Man tapes and everything. It goes on to sort of be quite well known doing other things. Becomes like almost like a professional public speaker, I suppose, at a point. Like a not quite a comedian, but like a funny guy, if that makes sense. Like a funny host. Does all these other things. I think he's involved in radio and gets back involved with football again. Really interesting career. But just on a cricket point of view, I think one issue they had with him is because his batting never quite came on, he was kind of like a Mike Hendrick bowler, in that very steady. But I think if you have a look, there probably aren't a lot of he took 6-5 wicket hauls. I take that back. But yeah, I think he was seen more of a steady bowler like not a particularly quick. And so they had Lenny Pascoe, they had Rodney Hogg. They also had a bowler like Jeff Lawson, who probably came on during Walker's career. So they had a few other people that either were faster, that fitted what they were looking for at the time, or they had other, you know, Terry Alderman would have been another one in his period as well. So they had quite a few good bowlers who could average around that 24, 27 to 31 kind of average, but it had other skills that Walker didn't have. If he'd batted better, and his batting had ever come on the way that everyone kind of always thought it would have, I think he would have been a much more important cricketer. But he certainly would have played for Australia a lot more. But I think he was one of the first people that Packer signed. Like he was a very important person in the Packer thing. And he retires in 81. So I think he retired quite early as well. Again, because by that stage, he had this huge personality and this huge reputation. And he had a lot of books to write, guys. He might be one of the highest selling cricket authors of all time. So of ex-players. Like, and I'm not joking. You know, how to kiss a chook or tame a tiger or whatever they were. MF Jim says, why are Archer and Wood all of a sudden looking less venomous? India seems to have the pace handled well. Is it just coming off the pitches that little bit slower? I mean, I think there's a few Indian players who are more used to pace. And, you know, this is, you're going up against the best bowlers, the best batters in the world, right? Like, that is what this lineup is. Maybe the wickets aren't helping them. I think Jofra's bowled some really good spells and he's looked very dangerous. And sometimes he's just got it wrong. And I think when he's got it wrong, that's when he's been punished. Wood doesn't have a second. It probably doesn't work for ODI cricket, but I'm just not sure that I would take Wood over Gleeson, because Gleeson has two or three different options and Wood has one option. And if it doesn't work, what else do you do with him? Jane says, where does Steve Smith rank in the pantheon of fielding greats? By the only two publicly available fielding metrics, catches per innings, he ranks pretty highly. In fact, of the top 50 fielders in terms of catches taken, only Bob Simpson has a higher percentage of catches than Smith per innings. But I feel like these metrics favour the Supercourt, and they do. To be fair, early Steve Smith was one of the best fielders I've ever seen. Like young Steve Smith in cover and point. Go back if you can find any of the early, especially some of the Big Bash highlights. I remember talking up his fielding incessantly. I think I had him at one stage ranked as the best fielder in the world. He's gone on to be a very good slip fielder as well, right? I don't know if he probably is a great slip fielder. His ability to get to balls other people can't get to, but also have good hands. I love the combination of that. I think we had him on our Crick Picks top 15 fielders of all time. And if we didn't, it was a mistake. I would have him as a top 15 fielder that I have seen. He combines bits of Ricky Ponting's athleticism. He's not quite at that level. He didn't keep that level as long as Ponting did. But he combines bits of Ricky Ponting's athleticism with Mark Ward's hands and ability to read ahead of what's going to happen. And that for me, yeah. A genius fielder. William says, I've been watching a lot of old blast highlights, obviously. That's why you follow us. And there are so many examples of specialist bowlers opening the batting as pinch hitters, often to great impact, such as Tim Southey, 74 of 34 for Essex. Why has this tactic died out? And was it any good in the first place? It died out for a couple of reasons. One is, sorry if I keep looking over here, there's a man at the top of a tree and I'm sure he's got a safety harness off and he's fixing the tree, giving us more room for the cricket net, by the way. But I am absolutely terrified that he's going to fall and die at any moment, because just the tree shakes so much. The tactic died off because people know how to bolt to Tim Southey. And in the 90s, it took a while for that to happen. But eventually, that's why pinch hitters died out in the 90s for ODI cricket. Was I was like, oh yeah, this guy can, if you bowl back of a length on the stumps, he'll just hoik everything over the leg side. But if you bowl full outside of stump, he doesn't have a shot, right? I remember, I think it was Junior Murray was doing it for the West Indies against Australia, and he got runs in the first game. And in the second game, Australia put out, I don't even know what you'd call it, like a cow corner fielder, but like 30 meters in from the boundary. So halfway between the ring and the boundary. And they were just like, every ball he hits goes there. And this is before analysis, right? But they played against him like two or three innings. And he couldn't make any runs because that's where he hit the ball. Like, Tim Southey is a limited batter. If he was really good, he'd bat at the top of the order all the time. You know, Graham Swan did it quite a bit in blast cricket. These days, he'd just get bounced. No one would bowl full to Graham Swan. a single delivery because we know enough about Graham Swan now. That's why it disappeared. The other thing is that the pinch hitter makes a lot of sense when it works, but we forget all the innings where they go in and they're 3 off 12. The pinch hitter can go wrong in a way that top order batters generally don't go wrong. So it's they are limited, and there are situations where I still think it's worthy doing it. I remember when I was at Melbourne Stars, we had John Hastings. Actually, he might not have played the year, but I remember we had the plan that if John Hastings was in, sorry, if there was a wicket and there was an off spinner, the plan was for John Hastings to go in because four balls of John Hastings facing off spin could be 24 runs, right? And then afterwards, you just tell him to slog and he's already ahead of the game. If you have someone with that kind of a skill set, and I think David Willey's a perfect example of that, and Sunil Narine are perfect examples of that, that if you have someone with that skill set or with that mentality, but they need to be better than Tim Southee, they need to be at the David Willey, Sunil Narine level. I always thought the two players I've always wanted to see as pinch hitters are Adil Rashid and Rashid Khan. I still think it's a good tactic. You can't use it every game. It doesn't work all the time, and you need to be smart and understand why you're doing it. Saurabh says, be honest, please. Is Shubman Gill a flat track bully? I hate this phrase, Saurabh. Every great batter in the history of cricket is a flat track bully, right? It's such a silly thing because, yes, of course he's a flat track bully. Of course everyone else is a flat track bully. If you're really good at batting, if the pitch gets flatter, you're going to be really good at batting, right? So I don't have any issue with that. Generally, flat track bullies have better records in drawn matches than they do in result matches in Test cricket. He averages 43 in draws and 44 in wins. So it doesn't show in his Test record. I don't think he's a flat track bully. I think he has a weakness of the ball coming back into him outside of stump. And that then causes a follow-on for some other weaknesses outside of that. But no, I don't think he's a flat track bully. I think he's really good at cricket. Thomas says, if a latter-day Kerry Packer offered you the opportunity to construct a one-off series with full substitutes, 11 batters, bowlers, keepers, and don't have to bat unless all-rounders, how would you go about constructing squads? If first class, how many days would you want to schedule to make a match that was a balance between bat and ball? I'd imagine par scores would be well above what we presently see. Would they? If you have substitutes, right? So let's think about this from a bowling perspective, Thomas. If you have substitute bowlers, so on day one, you don't worry about hit the pitch bowlers. You worry about, you just pick one, know what, the best five seamers available and you bring them in as substitutes. And I'm assuming that's what you mean. Because you said full substitutes. So on day one, if I'm England, what's my bowling attack? Jamie Porter and all the Jamie Porters out there are backing up. You know, Ollie Robertson comes in. I've got Jamie Porter, I've got Ollie Robertson, I've got Chris Wokes, I've got, you know, whoever else I could think of that fill those sorts of jobs. So they bowl with a new ball. And then in the middle overs, I substitute all them out. And I probably try my leg spinner for a couple of overs, and I have Mark Wood come in and someone else bigger, taller, who can whack it into the wicket for me a little bit, right? And then I keep going through that all the way through. Then I bring in my best reverse bowlers. I don't know who their best reverse is. It Mahmood? Maybe. Yeah, probably is Mahmood, actually. And Jofra. So they bowl towards the back end. I'd probably also have Jofra for the new ball. Then I'd bring back on my specialist new ball bowlers. I don't know. I don't know. If the par scores would change as massively, they would go up because you have 11 batters, but I don't think you'd be in a situation where you suddenly go from, let's say in first class cricket, an average of 32 to an average of like, well, you wouldn't go above 45, I wouldn't have thought, Thomas. And when you have that many specialist bowlers to pick from, I think you'd actually get it lower. Every time you bring on a bowler, it's because they're good at doing that job. Satchbro says, countries stop employing ODI coaches now that the format is lying on its ass. It seems pointless for England to have one, for example. I think most teams will just have white ball, red ball, won't they? Would be my guess. Until ODIs fall completely. Ben says, most right arm in swing actions fall away pushing the ball in. From what I've seen of Mafaka, his action falls away. So I wonder if he could learn to swing the ball. His action falls away. Oh, okay. I see what you mean. So I wonder if he could to swing the ball away from the right-hander. At which point, how dangerous would he be? So left-arm bowlers are different to right-arm bowlers biomechanically. And one of the reasons is I think they have to collapse. There is a reason. And some fast bowling coach, maybe Kath Dalton or someone told, I've got to get Kath on the podcast. Someone told me what the reason was, but it's because they have to collapse to allow the ball to float outside the other side. So he collapses more than most, you're right. But I don't know if that's going to help him with what you want it to help him with, because his arm is quite low, I think. And I think in order to do what you're talking about, I think his arm would have to be quite high. His bowling arm would have to be quite high. But I do understand. Yeah, and yes, he should be, any left-arm bowler should be working on this, not just him. Latouche says, assuming England has moved on from Folks, who's the best gloves in international cricket? A very good question. I don't know if I can answer that at the moment, too. I would have to go back and have a good look at it. I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure I have a fantastic answer for that. There's a lot of good ones at domestic level and just below, right? But at international level, I don't know if there's a clear standout in the way that perhaps there has been at other times. All right, let's have another quick break. And then after the break, we'll take questions from the Super Chat. This is the Wagon Wheel. A test happens when you're asleep. Where do you find the best match report? A cricketer's backstory is meticulously crafted by a great writer. But it's a day you're not on social media, and so you miss out. We all do this. It becomes almost a full-time job to follow the sport you love. But there is a solution. The emailer Best of Cricket can tell you what the main stories are and the best articles every single day. And when they can't find them, they even write their own. Now, instead of trudging through Twitter or Blue Sky, you can just wait for the Best of Cricket to email or WhatsApp the greatest cricket stories straight to you. Subscribe to Best of Cricket today. Lentils says, Duckett said he won't mind England losing 3-0 to India. Last year he said Jaiswal learnt batting from baseball. How come England fans are even accepting losing? Oh, well, they're not. They are definitely not. Barney Roney went all in on the Guardian column the other day. On TalkSport, we've been talking about brainless cricket pretty much all this series. They're not accepting it, but there is a cult at the moment. And look, I actually don't mind them losing 3-0 either. Like, that doesn't bother me at all. And I've said that heaps of times before. Bilateral cricket, especially before a tournament, should be about you getting yourself into the best shape possible. The issue at the moment is that England are playing very bad cricket consistently. That would be my issue. The 3-0 isn't the issue. You would have to be a maniac to believe that England could win the Champions Trophy at the moment. And that's coming up really soon. I think it was Butler at the press conference the other day. What did he say? He said, you know, we're going to try, you know, our job is to play really attractive cricket or something like that. It's like, no, that's not your job. It's never been your job. Genie says, more NBA than cricket this week for me because finally started watching it post the Doncic trade. Oh, well, Doncic AD trade. Finding the game so fun, especially LA Mavs and Golden State ones. Want a deep dive. Any help there? Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, if you're not with The Athletic, I would say the Lakers, Mavericks, and, any team that you want of the top 2022, like most famous teams, probably has an Athletic writer. So it's a great place to start. But they all have a Locked On podcast. So I think I've listened to the Mavericks one before. I think it's pretty good. I might have listened to some of the Lakers one before. So those ones are pretty good. But if you like a team, that's where you go. If you're looking for deep, deep stuff, there's a couple of great podcasts out there. If you want to learn about how basketball is played, and this is depending on how deep, Caitlin Cooper is, I think, the best person to go to. You're going to find out about everything that you need to know about the sport from her. But it's really deep. It's like she's essentially showing you what a coach is seeing during a game. Thinking Basketball podcast is brilliant. And, you know, I've talked about them before. I listen to it all the time. They come out once a week. You've got the John Hollinger stuff. So if you're on The Athletic, you can read John Hollinger stuff, but also his stuff. Zach Lowe, if he ever comes back, is another good person to take a look at. Who else would I look at? The Basketball Illuminati is fun. I think it's a great podcast. I was very sad when it disappeared. I'm glad that that's come back. I'm trying to think if there's anything else. so many punny like podcasts. They're very good at the sort of puns. The All City Network has some really good podcasts if you like individual teams. And I've got a couple more here that I now, of course, can't find. Young Man in the Three, it's not quite saying that now, JJ Redick is a coach. The Yahoo Sports NBA podcast is something I listen to quite a bit. And the Dunker Spot, that was the other one I was looking for. So yeah, I probably go there and then follow the writers. I follow quite a few writers on Substack. So people like Mark Stein out there. But yeah, there's once you get in, I kind of they're much better at kind of doing it all together. And so once you find one or two podcasts or writers that you like, they're much better than cricket at referencing each other. So that there's a community aspect so that you go, oh, okay, they've said this person is good, so I'll go follow this person. Oh, Sam Fassini. Shout out for Sam Fassini. He's also a cricket fan, lives in Melbourne. And he's absolutely great, especially if you like the draft. I've always been curious on how rarely we talk about MSD's batting technique and the and ability, and could he have made it as number 3, 4, or 5? Was he predestined to always end up at number 7? I think he's a very good player of pace bowling. I don't know if he ever would have gone up. Look, it is a weird technique. The fact that it was found out in Test cricket a little bit, and not massively, I think it was probably a technique more suited to the white balls when they got a little bit soft. And maybe the way he played technically held him back a little bit. But he had an incredible eye, and obviously he was very good at reading the bowler and the match situation. He had a true average of 50 and a true strike rate of -4 versus spin and a true average of 18 and a true strike rate of 1 versus pace. That's quite interesting, actually. But yeah, he was certainly I think he was a limited player in some ways, but he was very good at overcoming that. It's really interesting that him and Bevan and Shai Hope are three guys with ridiculous white ball records who are probably all should have made more runs in Test cricket than they did. Don is the only one of those guys who really was a success. Like, I think as a number 7, he was definitely a success. So Bevan and Hope were not. So there's something within their batting that I think plays a part. Sankop says, what according to you is the thinking behind giving Connolly a debut? I find it hard to believe that no one else has better credentials or whatever metric they pick him on because he hasn't played any first-class cricket. They see a young player who can spin the ball, who is a good fielder and can bat a little bit. And they're like, it's a test match that doesn't matter all that much, Sankop. So let's give him a go. Let's see what he's made of. And then we'll get a better idea of whether he'll be helpful going ahead. I don't think he's a test player based on what I've seen at the moment. But I don't think there's anything to be lost from putting him into that kind of situation so they can get a better look at him. Ikant says, how do batters change their shot mid-ball and learn to train to do it, especially when it comes to adjusting to sideways movement and change of pace? A player is making a bunch of decisions all the way through when the ball is being bowled. So this is going to sound weird, Ikant, but at a certain point, players have actually already started to make decisions before the ball is bowled, right? And I don't just mean running down the wicket or moving across the crease or anything. I mean, they've worked out where the field is. They've worked out where this bowler generally pitches the ball, and they're going to make a decision. So everything they do is a combination of, it's very rare for a player to think to themselves, I'm going to drive this next ball, and then the next ball is full and wide and they drive it, right? Like at the top level, it happens more at first class club level, but at the top level, that's very, very unlikely, right? So the vast majority of times they're like, okay, he's going to bowl, you know, I can't remember if it was AB de Villiers or Dravid, but one of them was talking about how you limit your options against 90 mile an hour pace to one or two things. And so as they're coming in, those are the things you're thinking about. And then you obviously then have to react to it. So the reason that they can do it is because they are premeditating essentially from the start. So why you are seeing them change their shot is because they are already premeditating what that shot is going to be before the ball has come out and then in the first 3 meters of the ball. Then in the next 17 meters of the ball, whatever it is, then you have the ability to adapt to that, right? So within the first 3 meters, they've probably already made a decision, and that might have been a decision that they were leaning towards anyway. And then the balls come out, and it's not quite in the area they've gone with, and they're doing that. I hope that helps. Some of this we don't know because it's a subconscious thing. It's very hard to get the players to explain it. What's your favorite questions and answers you've given on Q&As, written, Reddit, and video included? Thanks for doing these, by the way. I still love the Reddits in the old days. And the reason we do the Wagon Wheel, really, was I would never have done stuff like this if it wasn't for Reddit. You know, way back when, I don't know when my first Reddit Q&A would have been, maybe 2016. Maybe even before then. And I did those. And I remember when we had the Patreon, I was like, wow, that can be part of the Patreon from now on. Look, I don't know if there's any individual questions or answers I've given. I, as a writer, like to talk through my projects. So in the old days, it might have been my friends or my wife or whoever. These days, I do it a lot more through podcasts and everything else. And so it's why I go on smaller podcasts as much as I want to help out other people and everything else. Sometimes it's just like, oh, yeah, I want to talk about this thing because other ideas come from it. Overthrowing Cricket's Empire came out of me being on another podcast, right? Maybe even the 50 Greatest Batters might have come out, you know, the Art of Batting might have come out of it as well. So conversations are really important to me from that point of view. So I love Q&As from that, because you're going to take me in directions I don't go, and it stretches my brain. I'm lucky that I have the ability to think very fast and answer the questions in a way that clearly you'd like. There's 700 of you watching right now, right? Like, that's a decent number for what is a Tuesday afternoon, not in the height of cricket season. My favorite questions are probably more about the craft, because I really have a lot to say about sports writing, sports media, sports content. And in cricket, we don't talk about it. And I really like to talk about that sort of stuff. I've got my own course, right? Like, it's something that I'm really passionate about, and I, you know, like to help people out. So those are things I really like talking about. But realistically, if it's a question that grabs me at any time, I'll love it. But yeah, the old Reddit chats were great. Samit says, staying in test from 08 to 14, average 23 with strike rate of 42 balls. Who came closest? Jimmy, Rhino, pre-World War II, has anyone been that far ahead in for that long in their era? What would Ryan Harris's numbers have been? He would have averaged about 24, 25 at that stage. Wouldn't have had that strike rate. Maybe Truman? What would Truman have been like compared to other bowlers in his era? He's the only other one I can think of off the top of my head. But yeah, I was writing about this at the time, Smeet. We were seeing something quite special. Ekant says, cockroaches, greeting cards, swarm intelligence. What's the story behind the skills listed on your LinkedIn profile? So this is actually related to cricket, actually, a little bit. A friend of mine that some of you will know, Philip Brown, who is a very famous cricket photographer. I don't know how this happened. But he started endorsing me for skills, and it would come up on your LinkedIn profile. And then I did it for him. And we do it during test matches when nothing was happening. So you just suddenly get a notification on your phone. You are now an expert in greeting cards or swarm intelligence or cockroaches or whatever it may be. There's heaps of them. I'd have to go back and see the one. And it was a real challenge to come up with one that was weird and funny for the other person. Do you know what I mean? Like, you had to up, like, imagine being told that your skill is cockroaches, right? And like, you really had to up it in a level and find something really, really weird. And so we did it for ages. So I don't even know how many are on there. Like, I was in those days, I only had LinkedIn really so I could talk to players and coaches, because there's a lot of, well, especially coaches and administrators on there. That's the other reason I had it, right? It's the only reason I still have it. So I didn't take it all that seriously. But I do remember my brother-in-law being like, you've got a lot of weird things on here. You do realize that now. And I went, well, part of the brand. Maybe not. Samit says, for a top 50 test bowlers, would you separate paces and spinners or combine them? If combined, how would you rationalize such different skill sets? That's the question to me. That's the question. I know what the book is. I don't know what the list is. So I know how to write a book on bowling. I went through it the other day, and I've mapped it all out. I understand exactly what I want to do and how I want to do it, and really excited. You know, I mean, I haven't signed a contract with anyone yet. Obviously, the batting book hasn't come out yet. We're hoping that does well. If you guys want the book, the best way is to buy the batting book, and then I can do the bowling book. But yeah, really excited to try it, but I don't know how we do that. I really don't know. I don't know if it's just a ratio thing. It's really hard because sometimes there's only one spinner in a match, or there's one spinner on one side. It's like, how do you compare Shane Warne when Shane Warne is bowling and the opposition spinner is like, I don't know, Richard Dawson or Robert Croft, like, or, you know, some of the New Zealand spinners in the 90s. Like, what are we talking about here? And so you can't compare him to the other spinners in the match as well, I don't think, at that time. Like, I think the more I've come around to it, I do understand the whole Murley and Warne aspect of being the greatest bowlers of all time. But I don't know how we do it from a metrics and, you know, a logic point of view. But that's probably what that book is going to be in the end. I think the one difference I think I'll do next time is I want to write the book first and then worry about the list. Whereas last time we worried about the list and then we wrote the book. I think I want to do it the other way. But I still have to work out how we understand spin bowling, right? But yeah, it should be fun. Jack says, can you realistically compare two different players? Comparing people growing up with different variables, environment, culture, times, ambitions, friends and family with just stats is unfair, isn't it? Yes, you could compare anything, but you have to understand all those things. I mean, by the metrics you've just said then, Jack, almost nothing in the world can ever be compared to another thing. And comparison helps us not just to tear one person down and push one person up, but also to understand how things are different and how two similar players can get to the same position in their career from two different ways. It's a very odd question that you've put in there. In your life, I think you'll find, Jack, that you probably compare stuff all the time. It's a normal human thing. It's how our brains work, right? And it does cause issues, but as long as you're aware of those issues and the biases that you have, it still works. Ashubham says, how did New Zealand get good players despite constrained budget? New Zealand has a lot of natural advantages that a lot of other countries do not. They don't have a lot of wars, right? They have a very outdoor culture. They have, cricket is a big part of their nation building, not in the same way that rugby is, but it's still a big part of their nation building. They got together, though, and they worked out that they had to play differently, or not even play differently. They had to organize differently than Australia and India and England. And they came up with a system of finding the most talented players, working out role definition for them, and going with that. There are a lot of, they have NBA players, right? And Premier League footballers. I don't know if they have any, but they've had Premier League footballers. They produce athletes at a fairly high level for what is a small country, you know? So I think when you consider all those things together, there's a lot of advantages to growing up in New Zealand that you don't get in other countries. So New Zealand is a proper sporting country, right? School doesn't, there are lots of kids, boys and girls growing up in New Zealand who are encouraged to play sport and treat it as seriously as they do their schooling, right? That isn't the case in all the cricket countries, yeah? So when you get something like that and then you have good, it's not a poor country. Like, I know it's not a rich country, but it's not a poor country overall. The standard of living is quite decent. You have a lot of access to public access, sporting facilities that you don't get in a lot of other cricket countries, right? I think it was Ian O'Brien who said that where he's from, like, so many great athletes came from it, and there's like this center that everyone just went and played sport at, right? You know, if you come from somewhere with those kinds of facilities, you're at a huge advantage. So there are lots of natural advantages to New Zealand. It also has a real cricket culture, right? Like, that has gone back a long time of, look at how many of their players are related to other versions of their players. And then they were very clever in the way they professionalized and how they professionalized and how they've got the most out of BJ Watling and Neil Wagner. Those players do not play for Australia or India, right? Probably not for England. And the reason they don't play is they would have been seen as not quite good enough to just be, useful. Whereas New Zealand kept pushing until they found roles for them to work in, because they have to do that. So they get the absolute most out of their talent, whereas Curran Nair can just disappear, right? Even in Australia, really talented players could just go back into the system and not be pushed all the way through. South Africa. You know, Colin Ingram was going to retire when he was like 18, 19. Who's the other one? There's another really good player. Went on to play for South Africa who, like, it was a Heinrich Klaassen, might have been another one. Like, players disappear in those because there's so much more talent to pick from. New Zealand has to encourage. They have to keep Kyle Jameson around, right? Kyle Jameson wasn't a very good cricketer for the first 22, 23 years of his career, but he's an incredible athlete. And when his athleticism finally came through and he understood what to do, he became one of the world's best bowlers. That's harder to do in some of these other countries because you're keeping someone around when there's a kid who might average 50 ahead of Kyle Jameson. New Zealand don't have that issue. That's it for the Wagon Wheel. So thank you very much to everyone for coming on again. We'll be back very soon. We've got a bunch of podcasts and crick picks and everything. We have, what are the next two videos of the main channel? Oh, we've got a big thing on baseball that I did, which is really interesting now that we're on our fifth incarnation. I think I worked out during the video, maybe the sixth of baseball. And I've done a video on the Champions Trophy final of 2004. So those will be the next two big videos coming up. And then we've got a bunch of Champions Trophy content coming out after that. I'm Jared Kimber. Thank you, as always. If you're here on the live, throw a like. A like can be thrown. It's not like delivering a cricket ball where you need a straight arm. Throw those likes. Throw them as many times as possible. And if you're listening on a podcast app and it's easy, give us a 5-star review, give us put a comment in or whatever. All these things help. And thank you to everyone who's helped supporting us. And we will see you again next time.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work.
If you make any content, Minvo Pro is the tool for you. Take your long format content and cut it and slice it for social media. This AI-inspired weapon will turn your one piece of work into so many clips. Try Minvo.pro now.